All right, just a couple of announcements before we begin. This week, you should note that the readings are critically the readings that you will find online. A chapter for an unfinished book of mine is online, and really the materials for these next two lectures are really not going to be found easily in your book. So this is a divergence from what your textbook would talk about. I urge you to read that, because without that, probably it won't make sense. I've included this part of the course because I actually think that, unlike those who do anthropology, quote, the old-fashioned way, that I think this is a critical part of your knowledge of how evolution works, and specifically sex, and why sexuality is such an important issue, and why we need to understand it from an evolutionary point of view. So again, I urge you to do that. Don't think that you'll find this material in your text. In fact, the material for your in your text for this week will mostly be relevant later on in the course, but has some degree of relevance now. So let me begin where I ended last time, in talking about genes that have evolved to produce molecules whose primary function is to control another species' development or behavior. In other words, genes in one species that have evolved not so much for what that species does alone, but for how it controls another. Now, this will be relevant because when we begin talking about sexuality and gene expression in two different variant body types of the same species, sometimes more than two, then what we're talking about are also traits that have evolved oftentimes in one body type, male or female, for example, that play a role in controlling or modifying the behavior of those of the other body type. And, of course, that might not be a surprise when we think about it, but we don't oftentimes think about it as genes doing this. One way that it happens in nature, and much more insidiously than when we talk about it in sexuality and social behavior, is that it happens when typically a parasite produces some kind of a molecule that affects the nervous system directly of another species. I talked about this superficially when we talked about plants that produce compounds that affect the nervous systems, typically psychoactive compounds, that we, in fact, take advantage of, although they weren't evolved to produce hallucination and feelings of arousal and so on in human beings. They evolved mostly to manipulate potential predators like insects. This is an example. This picture here is an example of an ant that I want to talk about. And you'll notice that its jaws, its mandibles, are sort of green. That's not the normal color. And what looks like antlers coming out of its head are not part of the ant's body. So let me talk about how an ant gets to look this way by showing you an interesting little video. This is a video in which, see if I can turn the lights down so we can watch this. See if that does it. Not doing it. How about these guys? Oh! Plunged into darkness. Don't go to sleep. All right. This is a case of not just an ant species, but a fungus. A fungus that, in effect, preys upon ants. So in this particular case, the fungus is producing chemicals that change the ant's behavior. It's important to know that ants sometimes engage in this behavior, but not typically worker ants. This is a worker ant that's foraging for food. What normally happens, however, is that during a certain period of the ant colony life cycle, it produces winged ants. The winged ants are sexual reproducers, whereas these worker ants are asexual. That is, they cannot reproduce. The winged ones actually seek out the highest places they can get to. That is, they fly high above the forest floor towards the sunlight, out of the darkness, so they can be found and seen by other ants and sexually reproduce. So this behavior of trying to climb up high is, in fact, partly a fooling the ant into thinking that it's a sexual male or female. The second part, this biting in of the mandibles, when ants are really disturbed or really hassled, typically it's because they're being attacked by other creatures. And one way that ants worker ants now defend themselves against marauders is to literally clamp on in kind of a death grip onto the attacking animal and just sort of stick on there and hold on with their mandibles until it becomes uncomfortable for the marauding predator, in that case, chasing away the predator at the cost of their own lives. What's happened here is effectively a kind of hormone is released by the fungus into the ant's brain that confuses both of these two functions that never normally would show up under these contexts and manipulates the ant into climbing up to a high place so that the spores can now be rained down over other ants and continue the life cycle of the fungus. Last time, I described this using a term invented by Richard Dawkins, the author of The Selfish Gene, one of these interesting books of the 1970s about gene evolution. He calls this an extended phenotype, as I mentioned last time. Extended because it's no longer just in the fungal body. Its effect, its phenotype, the thing that gets it reproduced, is actually in another animal's body. Now, last time, I also introduced the idea that there's a relationship between sex and death. That relationship is simple, and that is that ultimately bodies will tend to die, but so long as you pass on copies of genes, the traits that the genes maintain will tend to live on and potentially can be around for millions of years. This is particularly driven home when we look at species in which death and reproduction go closely together. I talked about one example of this, salmon who swim upstream, literally killing themselves to get there in order to reproduce. And in their death, they, in effect, provide food for the microorganisms that will eventually be the food for their own offspring. In this particular example, one that many of you may know about, the praying mantis, the relationship between sexuality and death are a little closer at hand. And let me, I know Valentine's Day is coming up. I just wanted to prep you guys. So what's happening here? Why would the, why would these males let themselves get eaten? Well, first of all, the females are a little bit stronger than the males. Males, in fact, typically don't get eaten so often early in the season. But late in the season, typically what happens is that females have to not only lay eggs, but they have to create an elaborate egg case to protect their eggs over the course of the winter so that when the spring comes around, they will hatch into new mantises. This takes a lot of energy. Females need a lot of energy to do this. But also late in the mating season, before the winter sets in, effectively, ultimately, everybody's going to die. If you're a male and you haven't reproduced yet, the chances are you're not going to reproduce. So at this point in time, there's much more, you might say, much more desperation in the males to reproduce. Now, I'm anthropomorphizing here, but you get the point. That is, if you don't reproduce eventually, their genes don't get passed on. So evolution is going to favor males that as the season gets late and probably as food gets harder to get and you're more hungry, you're willing to take more chances in order to mate. Now, from the female's point of view, this is a real advantage because, in fact, you're starting to run out of food, too. Winter's coming up. You've got to lay eggs. You've got to create an egg case. You've got to protect your babies. It takes a lot of food and energy. And if it's getting hard to get, well, hey, having, a big chunk of food to eat here, a male who just kind of comes right up to you and offers himself to you is a real advantage. So females eating the males is a great opportunity. Now, from the male's point of view, although you may think it's not a great experience, On the one hand, it's an advantage because this guarantees that the female will have lots of nutrients in order to prepare her babies and, if you've successfully mated, your babies too. So in a sense, giving up your life as food ultimately can maybe make and take you into the future, so to speak, genetically. It can make you a better reproducer. So all of this is about sexual reproduction, but I want to begin by saying that sexual reproduction is not necessarily such a great thing, not because you might get eaten, but in fact because there are other costs to this way of reproducing. From an evolutionary point of view, it's not necessarily the best way to pass on the genes that you carry. For the one part, only half of your genome gets passed on to each offspring when you sexually reproduce. Half of your genes don't get passed on. And in fact, in every mating, there's a shuffling so that some genes may never get passed on no matter how many babies you make. Another thing that I mentioned before when I talked about the special case of a great combination of genes, for example, in the racehorse secretariat, is that good combinations of genes tend to get broken up with every sexual reproduction. So what works well together in one generation is not necessarily going to happen again in the next generation. That's a cost that if you were reproducing asexually and passing on all of your genes, the good combinations would stick around. There are also time and resources that are required to locate a mate. That is, you have to look around, you have to find one. It takes energy to find another individual. Potentially, if you're not so densely distributed in the environment, you have to spend some time looking around. That costs energy that you might have given off to offspring. In fact, as number five suggests here, if only one individual reproduces out of the two sexes, then in effect the other one that's spending a lot of time looking around too is eating up a whole bunch of resources that are not going to be directly offered to the offspring. So again, there's sort of a loss of resources by being a sexual reproducer. And in number four, there's a problem also. That is, if you're in a low-density population and you finally encounter a member of your own species, there's only a 50-50 chance that it's going to be of the opposite sex and a reproducible partner. So there's a lot of costs, a lot of risks, you might say, from an evolutionary point of view, in successfully getting your genes passed on. That is accompanied by sexual reproduction. So part of the question is, so why did sex evolve at all? And the answer is that to some extent, it was a safety valve. It was like a lifeboat in one sense for genes. So sexual reproduction became really dominant. It became crucial to social behavior, and it requires organisms to group together, to work together. And it allows something else. It allows the strategies, the tricks that organisms use to get their genes passed on. It allows them to be distributed in different body types, in different ways of reproducing, in different ways of producing cells and producing offspring. Male and female body types can do this sexual process differently. They can take advantage of different resources and different tricks. It also eliminates some of the costs of being a sole reproducer. What are the costs of being a sole reproducer? Well, in effect, you never recombine your genes. Yes, you get great combinations that you could stick to, but if the combination isn't so great, you can't really recombine it to shuffle them up to find maybe a better combination. So there are some costs to not sexually reproducing either. A lot of them have to do with this combinatorial option. And in fact, the possibility that if a gene becomes a deadly gene, every one of your offspring will get it. If it's a deadly gene and you're a sexual reproducer, it might be shuffled out of the mix in some of your offspring. So there's some safety there. The point I want to make here is that what we call sex, as a result, is not one thing. Sexual reproduction involves three major components that are all crucial to what we call sexual reproduction. And they can show up together and in different combinations. And as a result, it complicates the story. And so to really understand how this works, I want to walk you through different variants of reproduction that have different combinations of these three issues. So the first one is recombination, mixing your genes up generation upon generation. As I mentioned just a minute ago, sex allows that to happen. And isogamy, which I'll talk about next, after that, is this idea of gametes being different. That is, sex cells being different. Sperm and eggs are quite different from each other. That's anisogamy. That's a part of sexual reproduction as well. And then finally, something I'll call gender to distinguish it from sex is, in fact, this idea that there are different body types. These different body types do different things. They look differently, and they contribute to reproduction differently. These are all part of what we call sexual reproduction. And in fact, they're the result of what I called early on in the course disruptive selection. in which within the same species, different types of behaviors, different types of bodies are selected to be quite different from each other. There isn't an average body type any longer. There might be, for example, two. Sometimes we call them male and female. This happens because there, you can, as a result, have strategies of reproducing, ways of getting your genes passed on that are mutually exclusive, that can't happen together. And so by splitting them off into different body types, you can, so to speak, have your cake and eat it too. That is, you can do opposite kinds of things to get things reproduced, get your genes reproduced. But in fact, they don't compete with each other. They don't conflict because they're in different types of bodies. In this case, male and female. The case of the seahorse here I'll talk about in a second, in part because seahorses represent a different combination than we typically imagine. So first of all, why do we recombine? Well, I mentioned this before. Genes have to work in combination with other genes. To keep working combinations together during reproduction, we have to have them linked together on chromosomes. But linking them together risks having one of the damaged genes ruin the reproductive chances of all other genes linked to it. So periodically recombining and reshuffling genes basically allows good genes to escape being stuck with bad genes. And it's like genes that are troublesome. And it also, of course, includes adding variation, possible variations, to test out new combinations. The mechanisms to do this are many at the level of microscopic processes in cells. One of them is the sexual recombination, just the recombining of genes that happens in sex. But as I mentioned before, there's other ways this happens. Chromosomes can sometimes swap genes. We call this crossing over. And finally, there are lots of other things that go on in whole bodies where different genes are combined in different ways by, for example, cells coming together, not exactly, for example, like sperm and eggs. And we'll talk about some of those examples. But let's begin with one of the simplest ones, how recombination occurs in bacteria. For the most part, bacteria reproduce asexually. That is, they just divide, like most of the cells in your body, as they get reproduced. But under a variety of circumstances, particularly when things are going bad, when the environment isn't so great for your particular combination of genes, they engage in a kind of gene exchange process. And this picture is an example of that. This one on the bottom, with all its bristly stuff sticking out, has sent out a tube that punctures and penetrates this other bacterium. And one of the things that it will do is it will, in effect, parasitize the genes in this other bacteria, grab some of those genes, try to recombine it with its own genes, and come up with a different combination. This happens even if they're not of the same, quote, species. In fact, it's very difficult to find what we would call species boundaries in bacteria because they have this gene stealing and gene swapping tendency, many species. But this allows them to sample new combinations, to steal good genes, perhaps, from some other bacterium. In single-celled organisms, you can get this swapping of genes in other ways. And here we see microorganisms that come together. They just find each other sort of socially, so to speak, swimming around, and they link up with each other, and they swap genes back and forth. This is not like sexual reproduction, in which you get half of your genome and that's it. In this case, they pass on, each of them swaps half of their genome with the other. This is called conjugation. And so here, it's not really sexual reproduction, but it involves two individuals of an organism, of this organism, coming together and swapping their genes. So each one of them can then divide after this process and undergo asexual reproduction, but there's a particular timing in which it seems to make sense for them to begin swapping genes. Why would you swap genes? Because you're getting new combinations out of it. As a result, once they separate off again, they're actually different individuals. They have different genomes than they had before. So it's a way of sort of changing who you are from generation to generation. In this case, what will happen is you've now got a new combination of genes, and every time you divide, there'll be new traits expressed because of that new combination. So this is recombination with gene swapping, but not with a sort of a sexual reproduction process. But now there's a problem posed by gene combinations. Because under these circumstances, how can you make sure to exchange only exactly the corresponding genes, so you don't end up missing some essential genes or having too many copies of other genes show up? That is, if you're swapping your genes back and forth, how do you know you're getting just the right swap? You know, do I give up too many? Do I give up too few? Do I come up with a bad combination because some critical genes are not swapped? And the answer is that once you start swapping genes in this way, you have to be much more systematic about which genes get swapped. And as a result, most of these kinds of gene swapping procedures start out with two combinations. That is, start out, as Mendel suggested, with two copies of each gene, and two copies separated on separate chromosomes, that they can then swap one of the two chromosomes, but know that they've already had one. This process, which we call meiosis, in which you divide up the chromosomes that are duplicated of each other. That is, they're what we call homologous chromosomes. They have a common ancestral nature to them. They each derive from a complete half of the set of chromosomes that you have, therefore a complete half of the genes that are necessary to build your body. So when you swap just an exact half, you're sure not to lose anything, and you're sure to gain what you need as an opposite half again. So one of the real problems is that you have to figure out how to do this separation process, and to do it fairly and evenly, and to some extent sent randomly, so that you don't favor just giving up your bad genes or just giving up your good genes. You have to sort of do it in a random way. And this is what effectively happened with the evolution of this process that we associate with sexuality, meiosis. This is how sex cells are generated. In other words, you start out diploid, which means you have two copies of each chromosome, two copies of each gene, therefore. And in a process of dividing this up, you split these off into gametes that have one copy of each chromosome, one N here in the second generation of this cell process. And then eventually, as a result of combining genes from two individuals, you go back to having two of each copy, diploid. So it's this process of going from diploid to what we call haploid, having half the number of total genes, one each, back again to diploid. This whole process of meiosis, of alternating chromosome numbers to produce the sex cells here, is a process that fairly distributes genes. It took a long time for this to evolve, billions of years, well before multicelled organisms appeared. But this haploid to diploid alternation actually occurs in nature, sometimes in wholly separate bodies. And this happens in many algae, for example. And here I show one here, ulva. And what happens is, from generation to generation, whole plants can go from haploid to diploid. In other words, whole plants can have only one of each gene in all of its cells, and whole plants can have two of each gene in all of its cells. For the most part, when this happens, they're fairly simple organisms like algae. And under these circumstances, what happens is that they do produce sex cells to some extent, but these are basically equivalent to each other. They swim around and find each other and fuse together to become diploid. So they go from haploid to diploid. And in the haploid stage, they simply generate, split off some of these cells that go find other cells like them. And they become diploid. And then the diploid process splits off by meiosis the cells into haploid again, and you get what we call alternation of generations. That is, in one generation you're diploid, in the next generation you're haploid, in the next generation you're diploid, and so on. This happens in a lot of simple plants. As you can see here, there's not anything like sperm and egg yet. What we've done is we figured out how to make the swap evenly, and this happened over a long period of time in the evolution of single-celled organisms. But when we move to multi-celled organisms, it now becomes possible to take another tack in this splitting of functions. And this tack is what we call anisogamy. Now, an means not, iso means the same, And gamete refers to gametes, or sex cells. So literally, if you take this word apart, it means not the same kind of sex cells. That is, sperm and egg are not the same kind of sex cells, even though they're both sex cells. The sex cells are usually haploid. And typically what we find them in the form of as sperm and eggs, or sperm and ovum. Ovum refers to an unfertilized egg. One of these is selected for mobility, for the fact that it's cheap to make them, and you can disperse them easily and make a lot of diversity of them. And you don't have to worry that they won't survive long. Let a large fraction, 90-99% of them, just die, you know, in the process of dispersing, whatever this means. Because if they're cheap and you got a lot of them and you can make it without much effort, why not maximize their ability to spread them out in hopes that under some of these circumstances, one or another will reproduce. So sperm typically have been selected for this feature. On the other hand, there's another way that you can take advantage of characteristics, and that is select one kind of sex cell for high survival. Protect it. Don't let it get damaged. Don't waste it, so to speak. Invest it with a lot of resources. Pump a lot of energy into it to start with so that it's got a kind of a starter kit that can keep going. And, in fact, continually support it and protect it in some ways. Don't allow it to, in a sense, mix up just at random with just anything. Do your best to get it fertilized with just the right combination of other genes. But you'll notice that these two demands are really mutually exclusive. They're competing demands. And that's what produces anisogamy. That is, disruptive selection so that the average traits are selected against, and some sex cells have one extreme and other sex cells have the other extreme of these traits. And of course, the classic example is sperm and ovum. Here's a great picture of sperm trying to, you know, climbing all over this ovum, hoping to fertilize it. Only one will successfully fertilize it. The rest will be excluded and will die. In one sense, what we see here is, again, an alternation of generations, like we saw with haploid, diploid plants. But here, the haploid stage is one very, very tiny, almost parasitic stage in the body of a multicelled organism. The haploid stage of the body type is sperm and egg. You can think of these as haploid body types, but they're really simple. They're single-celled haploids. In this case, what we see is there's a massive difference in size and a total difference in numbers that are produced and, of course, in survivability and distribution. A big, well-provisioned cell is not going to be able to get around very well. So in one sense, it stays put. And what has to happen is the other kind of sex cell, the one from the other body type, the sperm here, have to find the egg. So again, what we see here is anisogamy is the result of splitting off these ways of maximizing reproduction. You want to have maximized combinations. You want to disperse things as far as you can. But you also want to maximize your ability to produce offspring, to make sure you make it past those early stages. And to do that, you can't make a lot. And it's very expensive to do. So sperm become basically expendable, but ova become critically protectable. You cannot waste them in the same way that you waste sperm, so to speak. So when we think about multicelled organisms like ourselves or like most plants and other animals, they're effectively colonies. And in fact, once we move beyond just the sex cells, we realize that these colonies are now capable of producing these different sex cells. But now the colonies themselves can also become different. It's one thing to produce different sex cells. It's another thing to produce different bodies to produce these different sex cells. We typically think of male and female associated with sperm and ovum, and with these two different strategies of cells reproducing with each other. But in fact, that's probably a misnomer, because in fact, these are separate processes. One is at the cellular level, and one is at a whole body level, a colonial level from the point of view of cells. the colony is producing these sex cells to reproduce another colony later on, so to speak. So what can you do with bodies that you can't do with these cells? Well, what you can do with bodies is that you can produce these in different ways, but also you can now aid the passing on of these sex cells differently. You can aid the way you combine with the others in different ways. And, of course, you can aid the way that you deal with resources differently. So we can think of differences in the rate of reproduction. That is, maybe one of these body types can produce much more of these sex cells. That the gametes, you now have a big body, you can put a whole lot more effort into some of these sex cells, or you can put a whole lot of more effort into producing lots of sex cells. You can spend time using this body to care for what the offspring are after they're produced. In fact, like we were talking about with the salmon who allow their bodies to be eaten, in effect broken down for their babies to eventually sort of live off of indirectly. You can also produce your resources so that your babies can actually have resources directly from your bodies. That happens with gestation in mammals and nursing, of course, in mammals. Resources of your body get passed directly to the babies. It allows the bodies themselves to disperse differently, to defend resources differently. It's not just the cells anymore, but now whole bodies can do this. And these two strategies can be differently mixed at the level of the cells and at the level of whole bodies. So I want to call this difference in bodies gender. Now, gender is a complicated word. It's not typically used in biology in this way. But what I want to do is to try to help you use a different word so you can see this difference in strategy, while sex is not just one kind of dichotomy. So gender, this difference in body types, is a way to mutually distribute these competing demands in the body that's carrying the sex cells. The result is you have separate body types. But in fact, because these are at separate levels, they don't necessarily always correlate in the same way. So you can have anisogamy, sperm and eggs, without having gender. How is this possible? Well, we call this effect hermaphroditism. What that means is that one body carries both kinds of gametes. It's possible for one body to carry both sperm and eggs. Now, we're familiar with this in plants. Plants have an ovum that becomes seeds eventually, and plants have pollen, which carries sperm. But a plant can have both sexes in its flowers. Not always, but oftentimes. We are not uncomfortable with seeing plants that have both male and female parts, but it's a little less common for us to think of animals that also have both male and female parts and that produce both kinds of sex cells. This is a kind of a compromise where the bodies are not disruptively selected. The body types are very similar. There is no male and female body types, no gender of body types, but there is a gender at the level of anisogamy, at the level of sex cells, of gametes. Now, in one sense, this independently uses these two strategies. And the question is, when might this occur in nature? When might it be an advantage to have the same body type but different sex cell types in the same body? The answer is oftentimes where access to mates is reduced, either because you can't move around very well, that is, it's hard to find each other, or you are in very low density in the population, or literally you're stuck to the ground or stuck underground, as in the case of these worms. Worms are a classic example of this kind of a problem. These are typical earthworms, annelids, for example. And it turns out that this capacity of having different body types is sacrificed because You got to find each other, and it's rare that you find each other. And when you do, you got to be ready to reproduce. If you spend all your time, you know, digging through and eating dirt in these isolated tunnels, you don't necessarily find each other very often. And as a result, earthworms have developed two kinds of strategies to do this. One is that if you chop them in half, as they talk about down here in this Far Side comic, you can get two whole individuals. They'll regrow heads and tails. This is a process in which the body development process does not go through any kind of direct reproduction. What's happened is that it just simply grows the other half. But also, and you can see they have these little rings around their necks, so to speak, if you look at an earthworm, this is an area where they have egg cases. That is, they're developing eggs. They have both sperm and ovum. When they encounter each other, they will exchange sperm with each other to, in effect, fertilize each other's ova. They don't, however, fertilize their own ova. One of my favorite examples is this one, and you get some idea of what you have to accomplish to do this. These are barnacles. Barnacles, as you know, are these little small organisms, they're kind of insect-like, that are literally stuck to the rock surface and can't move around. Well, if you can't move around, you're sort of like a plant. It's hard to find a mate. How do you find a mate? Well, we saw early on with plants the way you do it is you get some other species to distribute your sperm around, typically insects that do so for flowering plants. But what do you do if you're an animal underwater? Well, you're not going to find insects to disperse your sperm from one to another. So what do? Well, it turns out that you have to have both sexes. Why? Because it's likely that you're going to not find anybody else but one other kind of partner out there. So if you're capable of reproducing in both ways, your chances of reproducing are doubled compared to a species that's divided into just male and female. So what you can see here is you don't have to be male or female to be anisogamous. That is, you can reproduce with having a single body type. This is the case because, you know, you can't get around, so it doesn't matter that one might disperse better than you. But what it means is also that you have this interesting relationship in which typically you really have to time this process exactly, and you have to be able to get your sperm out if you're using your male part of the process to as many possible neighbors as possible as you can find. And this happens with barnacles, of course, again, because they can't get around very easily. Now, there are species that are hermaphroditic, but can get around. And here's some examples. One of these examples, and probably the most interesting one, my favorite one, by the way, are slugs. And these are some of my favorite, the so-called leopard slugs. I grew up in Seattle, where slugs abound. And it, you know, in some ways, one figures that Seattle must be the right place to live because, you know, so many slugs can't be wrong. But nevertheless, slugs have become remarkably able to produce, I think, the most sensual reproductive activity of any species on Earth. And I'll try to explain that to you in a minute. But again, almost all species that are related to slugs, like clams, or snails, for example, basically have trouble getting around. Slugs are the exception that can get around pretty well in comparison, but still, as you notice, that they're kind of slow getting around. They kind of, you know, squirrel along on top of this mucus that they lay down, kind of disgusting process from your point of view and mine, but in fact, they do so very well. What's interesting about slugs and the way they reproduce is that, in fact, when they find another slug, they've already found a potential mate. Anybody else you run into out there is a potential mate. And you can see that's a real advantage. If you're a slow-moving creature, that can be a real help to reproducing. So for this next one, I'm going to turn down the lights a little bit because it is just delicious. This is slug mating, if you will. So here we go. I know it's still early before Valentine's Day, but hopefully you'll remember that there are sometimes better options than our own. Again, what we see here is the body types are not different. The body types are the same, and yet they're sperm and egg, and their interaction is in many ways mutual and uses all the same logic. Sometimes we often wish that we had the same logic in the way we pursue these questions. Let me just summarize where we've gotten to so far, because it's going to get even more interesting, because there's another level we really haven't talked about yet. So first of all, there's three levels we've been focusing on. First of all, the gene level, where we see an exchange and a recombination effect. Then there's the cellular level, where we find different kinds of cellular strategies for mixing genes together. And finally, there's the strategy at the body level, in which we find what we oftentimes call genders. But as you can see here, the body strategy does not necessarily require gender in any simple sense. But oftentimes we do find animals, for example, like the peacock, where male and female are radically different from each other in their appearance. The typical gender difference that we take into account. Again, this is because at all of these levels, there's been selection for mutually exclusive reproductive adaptations, ways of getting your genes passed on that will work well together, but if you split them into different cell types or different body types, you get a very successful way of reproducing. So I now want to make this distinction that I've been suggesting all along, because now we're going to talk about the bodies that actually begin to differ. Typically, we call them male and female, but even there, we'll see that it's not quite so simple. So sex is typically understood in terms of male versus female, and we typically use this terminology to talk about male and female bodies. Sometimes we just use it to talk about the organs of reproduction, for example, in plants that carry only sperm or ova, though most plants, as I said, many flowering plants at least, have both different kinds of gametes. I want to use the term gender here just to sort of separate it in your mind to talk about body types. It derives from the same Latin word as genus or type to refer to, for example, types of organisms in which groups of species may be taken together. Or the concept of gen, like in generate, or to regenerate, to beget, to reproduce, to generate, to produce something. And finally, there is a kind. We can use it to talk about kind, again, like in genus. Now, this is typically used in linguistics to talk about, for example, nouns or pronouns, for example, markers of what we call gender for various kinds of nouns in different languages. So we use this distinction in language not to deal with sexuality, interestingly enough, but we use this distinction in language oftentimes to help us point to different kinds of things. It actually becomes an aid to pronominalization. To be able to say he, she, or it allows us to discriminate between different kinds of nouns more easily. So in one sense, we use gender in language in this sort of way of creating types or categories that are not necessarily what we normally think about as sexual. And what I want to do is to use that kind of analogy to help you think about this in terms of body types when we look at different animals. So the first thing I want to talk about is what happens if you give up sexual reproduction. There are cases in which organisms, species have been evolving sexual reproduction and they give it up. And so one of the things we can look at is what conditions might favor or disfavor of sexual reproduction versus asexual reproduction. That is just simply dividing or passing on your whole genome. So in asexual reproduction, there's not much competition for resources under these circumstances, so that you don't have to sort of compete with each other. You just produce your body again and again by dividing. And that means that conditions are probably pretty predictable. And what that should do is it should cause you, because you don't have to find other individuals, because you don't have to compete for resources with the opposite sex, and so on and so forth, reproductive rate can be advantaged. You can produce more babies faster. However, variation in those babies is declined, basically dropped to mostly zero, because in asexual reproduction you're not recombining. So what conditions would favor sexually reproducing in which you're recombining in this way? Well, if there's a lot of resource competition and conditions are unpredictable, under these circumstances, it may pay you to sort of hedge your bets by producing lots of different organisms that are quite variable as your offspring, because some of them might be better suited to the environment than even you are, or certainly all of their competitors. But the result of producing this sexually means that your reproductive rate has to go down for all the reasons we've talked about, but variation can go up. So as you shift back and forth from one of these two conditions, you can get a reversion from sexual to asexual, or an evolution of asexual to sexual. In fact, the important piece of this is that you can also get an alternation even within the same species. That is, the same species might go from a sexual reproductive phase to an asexual reproductive phase, or back to a sexual reproductive phase. So let me just talk about it this way, because it gives you a sense that the environmental conditions are crucial for what determines this sort of gendered-like difference in bodies and in whether they're going from sexual reproduction to asexual reproduction. So here, let's look at this. Is one of the favorites of this is dandelions. As we all know, dandelions produce a flower. They fill your garden. And the flowers produce these little sort of seeds, or parent seeds, on kind of little parachutes. They get blown around and go all over the place. What's interesting is that most dandelion reproduction, almost all dandelion reproduction, is what we call parthenogenic. That is basically in which you cut yourself in half and you make another one. Now, in plants that can be severed off, which you can sever off a piece of it and that piece will grow independently, you're doing just that. That separate piece, and down here we see strawberries doing the same thing, in which a shoot can grow out, set down its own roots, and even if it's severed from the original plant, that separate part can now grow independently. It's been estimated that most dandelions on the North American continent are really closely related, if not largely, members of one and the same individual that's become divided up like this and spread over the surface of the continent by simply sending out shoots that get severed off and yet produce a separate individual plant. The same is true with strawberries. Even though strawberries also have seeds, most strawberry reproduction is done by parthenogenesis, this sort of getting yourself cut and separating off into two separate individuals. So you can have sexual features like seeds, but do most of your reproduction asexually, in part because it may be an advantage in the environment that you're in. There are species, however, that do so within each individual lifespan and across generations, going from sexual to asexual. And my favorite example are these little aphids. You see them climbing around down here. But also here you see them blown up, aphids that can take over your plant. And you can see there's a bazillion aphids eating up this plant down here at the bottom. Aphids are a real problem. Anybody that's raised indoor plants oftentimes over time will come into conflict with aphids. And aphids, once they start to infect your plant, so to speak, they reproduce rapidly and basically take over the whole plant. And it takes a lot to get rid of them. How do they do this? They do this because when they land on a plant, when they colonize a new plant, they reproduce asexually. And let me show you an example of this. This is an aphid giving birth. Aphids are insects that give birth to live babies, not to seeds, not to eggs, but to live babies. And here you see a mom aphid giving birth to baby aphid. This is happening as the aphids have landed on your plant. Only a single aphid needs to land there. You don't need to have two aphids, mom and dad aphid. You just have a single aphid that can reproduce asexually. And as a result, if this is a plant in which nobody else is there, boy, your babies have a lot of food available to you. Reproduce them as fast as possible. And in fact, if you don't need to find a partner to reproduce, you can even get your baby to start the reproductive process before it's born. And that's actually happening in this baby aphid's body. They're already starting the gestation of the next generation as it's being born. This means you can really kick up the rate of reproduction extensively. And let me just show you this little baby coming out here. Again, live birth is being generated in this way. This little aphid is going to come out here. It's going to be fully ready to eat on its own. There you are out there. It's starting to eat on its own. This is how it can rapidly take over a plant. The problem is, at some point in the aphid's life, I think the next picture shows this. No, not yet. Let's back up here on the aphid's life. At some point in an aphid's life, you've filled the plant. Everybody's eating the plant, and there's no space for you to grow. And in fact, the plants usually respond by excreting toxins of various kinds that make it difficult for the aphids to really kill off the plant by eating everything. At this point in time, rapidly reproducing is not going to be a very big advantage. So what happens is, as the population gets more dense on the plant, as the plant begins to resist aphids feeding on it, aphids begin to produce babies that can't produce their own babies on their own. They produce male and female aphids. Those male and female aphids now fly off. They have wings that the normal aphids don't have. And they can leave the plant and find other males and females, reproduce, recombine their genes, and their offspring now can land on a plant and begin to reproduce asexually again. So they alternate between this asexual reproductive period, when resources are plentiful, and go to a sexual reproductive period in their life, when they have to start varying the way they take advantage of plants. And so we see this alternation. In one sense, sexuality is a strategy in this kind of animal for different kinds of ecological conditions. And I want you to begin to think about this, that gender is not just something that's in the genes, so to speak. Gender is a response to a particular environmental demand. And those environmental demands may change over the course of a lifetime, but they may also change within a lifetime and causing you to change the way you reproduce. This allows us to deconstruct the sexes in an interesting way. So the body types and the behavior patterns are associated with various reproductive roles, that is, how you reproduce, reflects a convergence of disruptive selection pressures for pushing different ways of reproducing apart in different body types, sometimes across different individuals, but sometimes across time in a single lifetime or across time from generation to generation, as in the aphids. And so what we see is a kind of set of common packages. We want to describe as a gender a sort of package of these reproductive strategies, as I've called them, that tend to work together well in a particular species in response to a particular demand from the environment. It's a cluster of reproductive traits, that is, traits that work together, and they produce a kind of strategy that biases different things in different bodies. And as a result, we can see that oftentimes this strategy links to the difference between producing sperm and ova, in part because they too are separated by virtue of issues of diversification, of being able to spread out, being cheap to produce, being expensive to produce, and so on. So oftentimes we find body types diverging on the sperm and ovum difference, in which the one normal body type difference that we consider male and female. But in fact, it's nevertheless not that simple, because the reproductive functions that they're engaged in may not split up in that nice, neat way. And if they don't split up in that nice, neat way because of unusual ecological conditions, you can have things changing over time in various interesting ways. So there's no essence of maleness and femaleness, or feminineness or masculineness in sexual reproduction. It's dependent upon an adaptation to an environment and different ways of combining tricks to get your genes passed on. And so it's these mutually conflicting selection pressures that really determine what kind of a body organisms have in male-female types. So one of the best ways to look at a slight twist in this combination is, for example, to look at seahorses. Seahorses have a kind of reversal from what we would expect. I put reversal here in quotes, in part because it's not a real reversal of anything built into biology. It's just a particular reshuffling of these tasks of what the body does. So what we see in seahorses is that males are effectively impregnated by females. They do this by laying their eggs in a pouch. And here we see this pouch enlargement. Here we see a pouch in which there's some of these eggs, just it got too many eggs and they're kind of spilling out. Females really load up the male's pouch with eggs. So it's a little bit like, you know, a marsupial in some sense, except the male has the pouch. Here you can see as the eggs begin to mature, turning into small seahorses, they in fact enlarge and enlarge and swell this pouch. The male is, in a sense, protecting the eggs as they develop into small seahorses. The eggs will hatch, and effectively, the babies will come out of the pouch, and here you see them coming out of the pouch of this male seahorse, and start feeding. But in fact, if a predator shows up, or if there's danger of some other kind, these little babies zoom back inside the pouch, where they're protected by their father, so to speak. So here we see a male caring for the offspring, in which the female, all she does is squirt some eggs into this male's body. And the male, inside of his pouch, inseminates the eggs and raises the babies. You can see it's a different mixture of these different ways of dealing with anisogamy and the body that takes care of it. Well, let me just give you a sort of a little picture of this process. Here's we see two seahorses, a male and a female. You can see the male has a pouch, a big fat pouch there. The female is going to squirt some eggs into this pouch. Here she goes. That's all there was to it, I guess. Now you see the pouch is swelling, full of eggs, and those eggs will develop into little seahorses, and eventually the seahorses will hatch inside of there. Oh, there you see some swimming out. Little tiny guys being born, so to speak, although they'll go back into the pouch also under certain circumstances. So this is a different combination of those processes, not simply sexuality as we think about it in terms of mammals and ourselves, but a different combination of these strategies mixed together, in part for different reasons. In this case, it's because the male tends to be a better defender of the babies, and this way females can go around and find lots of different males to inseminate. Got a question? Should the female be more decorated than the male? Sometimes that is true. And we typically find that decoration in seahorses is, however, mostly camouflage. Seahorses make themselves oftentimes look like the plants that they grow around. And so it's hard to say which one is more decorated. This is not that males are in the process of being courted by females and that females are, in effect, trying to attract males. What's happening is that they're looking for the males that are probably the best camouflaged or the best able to raise offspring. So it's a slightly different variation. I'll come back to this sort of decoration issue maybe next time. Yeah. There is no clear courtship in this species. There is a period of time in which they're sort of testing each other. It's not clear in my mind whether there's a clear courtship in this process, but raise some seahorses and you can tell me. Some other mixtures of gender role strategy. Here's a giant water bug. When I was a kid, I actually raised a giant water bug that I found in a lake once. They're beautiful bugs about this long, about 2-3 inches long. They're predatory bugs. They eat other bugs for the most part, but also worms and tiny fish fry and so on. What happens in this species, interestingly enough, because the male is a particularly formidable predator, is that females will lay eggs on the back of a male. What happens is the male fertilizes the female, and then the female lays her eggs on the back of the male, and the male swims around with these babies on its back. It doesn't feed them, but effectively by being on its back, they are protected. This is true for a number of kinds of insects. Some scorpions, for example, engage in the same behavior in which the male carries the eggs on its back. Even some frogs will do this, in which the males will carry babies on their back. Again, what's happening here is it's not that they're feeding them, but they're protecting them. The male is, to some extent, a more formidable individual and less likely to be preyed upon, therefore can defend its own eggs. So I like to call these different things reproductive strategies. They're tricks for reproducing, so to speak, ways of behaving, ways of building your body, strategies for getting your genes passed on. And so the particular combination that you end up with is, in effect, the result of the demands of reproducing, the demands that are imposed by the environment, by potential predators, by need for resources, a whole range of these things. These types of bodies reflect these trade-offs of strategies and how they fit in the world. So in many ways, gender is about adaptation to an environment. It's not just something that comes as an essence of being a sexual reproducer. So here's another favorite example of mine that sort of gets this idea across. This is a fish called the blue-headed wrasse. Blue-headed wrasse are interesting because they all begin life as females. They live in a school of fish, mostly females, and it's defended by a single male. On average, the male is much larger than any of the other females, and he has a distinctive blue head, so he can be distinguished from all the females who lack a blue head. The females swimming around periodically lay their eggs, typically in coral reefs. The males come around, and they inseminate their eggs by squirting their sperm over these eggs. One male keeps all the other males from neighboring groups away. So this male is defending a territory in which a group of females are there. And that male can be quite successful. Interestingly enough, males, however, have a fairly short lifetime, in part because they're always defending against other males, which they can easily identify by their blue heads, but also because of their blue heads and because they're out there, so to speak, they're also the first ones to be eaten by predators. What's interesting is if this male dies, one of the largest females in the group will become a male. She'll transform from female to male. Now, up to this point, her gonads were female gonads, ovaries producing eggs. That gonad literally undergoes a change and becomes a male gonad and starts producing sperm. And as this happens, it also changes the color of the head of this animal. So what's happening now is that, in effect, this reproductive pattern, strategy, if you will, depends upon males defending a territory with a bunch of females. And females, because now they can be small to lay a few eggs here and there over time, wait until they've matured enough. You have to be big. You have to have matured over a long period of time to be at the level that you can now defend a whole area against other males. So across the lifetime, in effect, the ecological context, the context of reproduction, has changed. The bigger you get, the more benefit there is to becoming a male. While you're small, there's no benefit to becoming a male because, in effect, you can't succeed. But as you get bigger and bigger, it becomes more likely that you'll succeed, and as a result, there's a sex change as a result of this. The reversal happens with so-called anemone fish, also clownfish. Anybody who's watched Finding Nemo, this is about clownfish. They have an interesting lifetime because what they do is that they colonize sea anemones. Now, a sea anemone, and you can see it here, has all of these little tentacles sticking out from it. These actually have little sort of trigger devices that send out little almost like darts that have a little bit of a poison in them that can paralyze small fish and other small creatures that fall into their tentacles, so that when something brushes up against these tentacles that is, you know, food-like, it introduces this tendency to cause these things to send out these tiny little sort of darts that will paralyze the prey, and as the prey sort of paralyzed falls into the anemone's grasp, the anemone will then digest it and get food that way. The anemone is actually an animal, not a plant. The clownfish, or anemone fish as they're sometimes called, live in anemones, and they succeed in living there because they coat themselves with a kind of a slimy surface that the anemone doesn't recognize as potential prey and doesn't actually harm them. And when it does, for whatever reason, send out a dart or two, it does not seem to harm these fish. The result is that a pair, a male and female pair, will occupy a single anemone. That is, it's a limited resource. It's only so big. And one pair can occupy that and lay its eggs inside of that, allow its babies to mature, and have that anemone. Eventually, the babies have to leave and find their own anemone. But in this case, they all begin life as males. Just the reverse of the blue-headed wrasse. And the young males, Nemo was a male because he was a little one. They don't actually show that Nemo is supposed to become Nima or something later on in life. But what's happening here is that what matters most, since you've got a protected resource, it's all yours, it's your home, nobody else is going to be there, being a female, it's better to be a female when you're big. Why? Because it takes a lot of energy to produce eggs. You've got to put a lot of investment of your own body, so to speak, into making these eggs. And so to be really successful at reproducing as a pair like this, the male doesn't need to be very big. He only has to make sperm. But the female has to be big enough to produce eggs. So what happens is as males mature and eventually leave, they go out searching for other anemones where there's a female looking for a young male. And the male will come in and court the female, and now they'll raise their offspring together. But when that female begins to age, because she's been growing for a lot longer, she's a lot older than the male, she'll no longer be able to survive and effectively will die, be picked off by a predator maybe. That young male will now, since he's got his own anemone, will turn into a female. And now other males swimming around will be looking for him, and eventually he'll attract them down to become her husband, and so on. It continues. So here we see a reversal of this strategy of changing sexes. So the point I want to make here is that sexuality, as we think about it, or gender as we think about it, is not something built into your genes. It's something that has to do with how bodies have adapted to an environment. That environment can be stable, in which you might find stable male and female, but that environment can also change from generation to generation. It can also change even within your lifetime. Thank you.